9 is going to be operating with that VISWAR, and if that's creating an amount of extra insertion loss that you're not happy with, you haven't changed it. So the needles that you look at, let me drop. The needles that you look at with that matchbox, which usually are adjusted in such a way that you're looking at input match, not output match. I think some of them give you an output match capability, but most of them, people dwell on the input match. They twist the knobs until the input match looks like 1-to-1. The transmitter's happy, and they assume everything's hunky-dory. Usually it is if your feed line is low enough in loss. So I think this is what you're getting at, Doug. For the AQSAY, how long have you been listening on the 375 machine? About time we hear from you, K2RIW in the TechNet.
To get back to about SWR bridges in the old days, Dick, is something different.
I hear you. Doug first. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, how you doing, Nick and the gang here? Yeah, you pretty much interpreted what I said, and I think that's fair. Well, I've been listening since, I guess, about maybe a quarter to nine or something like that. I tell you the truth, I tend to forget that you guys are here on Sunday night. And if I remember it and I'm not doing anything else, I come back and listen for a while and see. I thought maybe you did the antenna matching network to death here, but maybe by this time everybody's got a good feel for it. WA2SAY, back to that.
WA2VDH with a comment.
VDH recognized. Because there's a darn many emails that Mel and I get on that one, Doug, that's the reason why we have to dwell on it. Even though, for the people who already know it, it's a boring subject, I know. And it sounds to me like tonight is one of the very first nights in which you've listened to the 375 machine. Now, Mel's got some further comments on VISWAR, and then we'll pick up VDH in that order. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
So the matchbox date came out in the 50s, and how the SWR, that's how you did. You adjusted that matchbox, you turned the knob until the needle sort of dipped, similar to the way you tuned and loaded the transmitters of the time. But that RF measurement, that way that so-called SWR was measured, Dick, is not based on the principles of the SWR bridge that you buy today that has a length of line, a length of coaxial line or whatever, and then you have a diode going one way and a diode going the other way, and that's how it was measured. Absolutely not in those, in that matchbox, the SWR unit that they sold that was optional. If you open it up, what it had a whole gang of resistors in it between two plates. A bunch of non-inductive resistors. Did not have a length of line. Now, I don't want to take the time to get into how this works, but you didn't have that same configuration of how today you measure SWR. That's the basics of how they did it, a little different in those days, over.
Mr. Tango Victor, you're after John, VDH. There's an infinite number of ways of building a standing wave ratio bridge. Wheatstone bridge, mini-match, money-match, I think it's called. There's ways of doing it with pieces of copper tubing. There's ways of doing it with snaking a piece of enameled wire underneath the braid of the coax. There's ways of doing it with toroids. There's ways of doing it with a 0.1 ohm resistor and other kinds of circuits. All you have to be able to do is measure what current is flowing along the center conductor, what voltage is between the center conductor and ground, and what is the phase angle between the two. You could say that the sampling probes that are inside a vector network analyzer do that. You could say that. It's a little bit more complicated. There's a 12-point correction procedure going on with a real tri-plate strip line directional coupler with a calibration procedure. But there's an infinite number of ways, or there's a very large number of ways of making a standing wave ratio bridge. Some of them are kind of directional coupler that's built into the slug of a Berg watt meter. It really does measure independently how many watts is flowing forward and how many watts is flowing in reverse, and it has something like 25 decibels of directivity. In the forward mode, it only sees forward power. In the reverse mode, it only sees reverse power, within reason. But you can't stretch that too far. If you've got an extremely good antenna with a 1.01 standing wave ratio, where you're putting 1,000 watts forward and half a watt is coming back, it is very tempting to unplug the kilowatt slug and plug in the 10-watt slug in order to measure reverse power. Do not do that, because there's a built-in termination in that slug that cannot take a kilowatt of forward power, even though you're only trying to measure a fraction of a watt of reverse power on a 10-watt slug. You'd be amazed how many people are falling in that trap. You don't really understand what's going on if you do that. Okay. The next person who signed in was John, WA2VDH. Go right ahead with your comment, John. K2RIW. My name is Dick.
And then you with a question.
Okay, fine. This is good evening to the net. Nick, I wanted to go back to that 5.8-to-1 SWR antenna that reflected 50% of its power. And this is the way I've been understanding it. The rig puts out 100 watts. Further down the line, we have the tuner. The tuner adjusts 1-to-1 SWR as seen by the rig. And whatever power gets reflected from the antenna, the tuner reflects back. So if the transmitter puts out 100 watts, between the transmitter and the tuner, let me drop. Between the transmitter and the tuner, we see a forward power of 100 watts, reflected power of zero. Between the tuner and the antenna, we would probably see, as I think of it, a forward power of 200 watts, a reflected power of 100 watts. The tuner re-reflects the 100 watts back to the antenna, combined with the 100 watts coming from the transmitter to make 200 watts. The antenna accepts and radiates 100, reflects 100 back to the tuner, which re-reflects it back in a forward direction, around and around. I think that's the way I understand it. Go ahead, Dick.
John, I haven't rechecked those numbers, but you're very close. You've got the principle. The numbers may be a little bit different, because you've got to be careful of one other thing, and that is, we amateurs think in watts. Mother Nature, you could say, always thinks in volts. So that antenna with a half power reflection coefficient, in other words, of whatever power hits the antenna, half of it is reflected. You could call it a power reflection coefficient of half power, or minus 3 dB. You could also call it a voltage reflection coefficient of, I think it's 0.707, yes. Whatever voltage gets to the antenna, 0.707 is being reflected by the antenna. And so we keep saying the power that comes back to the matchbox gets re-reflected forward. That's absolutely true. But it's really a voltage reflection. If you really want to know exactly what's going on, you should calculate the voltage, the 0.707 volts that comes back from the antenna on a unity system. 1 volt going forward, 0.707 coming back. Let me drop. The 0.707 volts gets re-reflected forward with the brand new voltage coming from the transmitter. The transmitter is making 1 volt on its input end, but the matchbox is converting that to some other voltage. And so you've anticipated that if we recalculate everything back into watts, that there's really 200 watts forward and 100 watts coming back, and I think that's right. I think that's right. But you balance the wattage, you have to balance the voltage. The numbers could be a little bit different than that. But conservation of energy, of course, is being preserved, and energy is bouncing back and forth. That creates a extra insertion loss of your transmission line, because the power isn't flowing through at once. Part of what goes on, let me drop, that creates great confusion is that when you're using that matchbox correctly, and you're running a 100-watt transmitter, and you put your bird watt meter between the transmitter and the matchbox, you will see 100 watts flowing forward and 0 watts flowing back. That's a 1-to-1 fanning wave ratio. Take that exact same bird watt meter, put it after the matchbox in the feed line going to the antenna, you're going to see considerably greater than 100 watts forward, and whatever that forward power is, half of it you'll see coming back when you use the bird watt meter by rotating the slug in the reverse direction. That phenomenon confuses the daylights out of people. How can I have, or maybe it's 180 or 200 watts going forward, when the transmitter is only generating 100 watts? At first, it looks like you're getting something for nothing. Some people start explaining that by saying, well, there's reactive energy going on. And you could look at it that way. The power bouncing back and forth, you could call it reactive power. You could call it reactive voltage. You could call it voltage reflection coefficient. I'm going to reanalyze those numbers. And by the way, in order to have a simple circuit, I guess it was Wesley, and pretty soon Alex is going to be discussing with us dummy loads. Let me drop.
Bob, comment.
Bob is recognized, but you're going to be after Alex. And that is the completely shielded antenna tuner. We didn't get a beep on that one. Wait a minute. The completely shielded antenna tuner could be made out of a pure non-reactive 50-ohm resistor. I could then decide that I want to make it into a 5.8 standing wave ratio. 5.828 is approximately the standing wave ratio width. 3.01 dB power gets reflected. Half the power gets reflected. And you're about to say, how in the world can I make inside that dummy load, my antenna made by Heathkit, for instance, how in the world could I make it reflect half power in order to give a full test of my matchbox? And the answer is quite simple. Take your 50-ohm resistor, put in series with it a 100-ohm reactor. Doesn't matter if you make it 100 ohms of capacitor reactance or 100 ohms of inductor reactance, but at that frequency, a 50-ohm resistor in series with a 100-ohm reactor will be exactly a 5.828 standing wave ratio, and whatever power you put into it from a 50-ohm transmission line, exactly half of that power, 0.707 of that voltage, will be reflected. That's the series equivalent circuit, 50 ohms in series, 100 ohms of reactance. There's a parallel equivalent. You could also take the 50-ohm resistor and put a value of reactance in parallel with it, and it's not going to be 100 ohms. It's going to be some other number, but we can calculate that. So that's one way of doing it. But people get very confused when they see that extra power appears to be occurring on the output of the antenna tuner. I know that Alex wants to make a comment on this, and then we're going to go over to Bob in that order. N2NNU, we're hearing from you the first time tonight, a man from Wanton Yonkers, K2RIW. You got it, Alex. Wait for the beep and look at your watch.
Unfortunate, I don't have a watch yet. Good afternoon, good evening to everybody, one and all. Yeah, it's, I first encountered that notion of what they're calling it an SWR gain by reading Maxwell reflections. And it was quite interesting. And recently I did some experiments with my tuner. And I observed that, truly enough, the tuner shows some sort of output gain when I detune a little bit my tuner. In other words, when the tuner is showing zero reflected, I have 100 watts. If I detune it a little bit, I will get 110, 120 watts or something like that. And I was pondering, is that really radiated power, because it shows on the meter of forward, so probably it should be a radiated power. But I don't have a field meter to confirm that. Maxfield strength meter. But it seems that Maxwell's is going all the way to say that this is beneficial. What do you think about that, Dick and to any of you?
Yeah, that's a darn good question, Alex. The bottom line is that every transmitter you and I can normally use, traveling wave tubes are the exception, but every tube-type transmitter, every transistorized transmitter, the tube, particularly if it's a tetro tube, and the transistor, particularly if it's a bipolar transistor, and most likely field effect transistors, those transmitting devices are nearly a constant current generator. As such, they have an internal impedance looking back into them that's extremely high. We do not impedance match our transmitters. You may think you're impedance matching the transmitter, your power matching the transmitter, your performance matching the transmitter. The manufacturer of that transmitter, in theory, has guaranteed to you that if you load that transmitter with a 50-ohm load, he will give you specified performance. He'll give you slightly more than 100 watts of output. He'll give you a certain amount of single sideband linearity. Let me drop. He's guaranteeing the amount of intermodulation distortion. He's guaranteeing the amount of forward power. He's guaranteeing the on-off ratio when you're running Morse code. He's guaranteeing the performance when there's a 50-ohm load there. There's many a transmitter. If you present to the transmitter something slightly different, maybe it's 45 ohms for your transmitter, and maybe it's 61 ohms for my transmitter. At some other load, and maybe reactive, the transmitter will produce a little bit more power. That's the good news. And maybe you're measuring the power in the CW mode key down. However, when you do that, there is no guarantee that when you line up the transmitter and the antenna tuner or matchbox in that manner, there is no guarantee that when you use it that way, you're going to get the specified linearity. You may start doing some splattering. You may have some extra intermodulation distortion. You're using the transmitter in a way it wasn't designed for. But you take any of our transmitters, and I've done that on one occasion, and it's difficult, but use the right kind of instrumentation so that you can look back into the transmitter while it is transmitting power, and you measure that impedance. It is far from 50 ohms. So as such, you can get some weird effects as you intentionally detune your matchbox in certain directions. I wonder if that makes a little bit of sense. I know I didn't answer your question, is that real radiated power? By way of properly using a Berg wattmeter and understanding what's going on, we could answer that question. I think there is an increase in radiated power, but at the sacrifice of linearity, most likely. But I'm not absolutely sure on that one, as you can tell, Alex. N2NNU, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, the simplest way it is to put a field strength meter out there and take a look at it while you're doing that, and that will tell you if you actually radiate or not the extra 10 watts or whatever it is. But it dawned on me that this subject that Maxwell is discussing in its books is something that I never heard before until I didn't get into the nitty-gritty of some antenna design, and there it was, SWR gain. I scratched my head. I said, what is that? So this is how finally I got into that subject. Okay, Dick, I know you didn't answer the question. I don't expect you to answer all the questions. The thing is that I have to do my own homework, but I guess that this, some of it will be irradiated, so there is no way to keep the water in the bucket if it has a hole. Back to you.
I've got one other piece of good news for you, Alex, and it's going to be a hard one to believe. We are slowly coming to the conclusion, this assembled group of supposedly smart RF people, that our matchbox does not ascertains the true standing wave ratio of our antenna plus feed line. If you don't change the feed line, or if you don't change anything at the antenna, whatever standing wave ratio that antenna has with that feed line stays the same. By weight of your matchbox in the shack, you can make that antenna look like almost any impedance you want, but the real impedance of the antenna through that transmission line is not being changed. Once you accept that, and assuming now that your transmitter is only putting out one frequency, the right frequency, and there are no harmonics there, under those conditions, when you put your bird watt meter or any other kind of voltage sensor, current sensor, or power sensor in the transmission line going to the antenna, once you've got a sensing device in that transmission line, and you twist the knobs on that matchbox and your transmitter so that the apparent power forward, or the apparent voltage on that line, or apparent current on that line, goes to a maximum, you are increasing forward power to that antenna. You can confirm it by putting a field strength meter out there if you want to. But whatever you do to at one fixed position, at one fixed frequency, with only fundamental energy there, whatever you do to maximize the voltage, maximize the current, or maximize the apparent forward power on that transmission line, you are truly maximizing the power radiated by that antenna. There are a lot of people who give me flack on that one, and I can fight that one pretty strongly. I know it doesn't sound sensible at first. I think Bob is not going to completely accept that one. I understand that. Bob wanted to make a comment. Make sure you wait for the beep, Bob. W2ILP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the net, this is W2ILT. I'm going to surprise you because I'm going to agree with you. And let me tell you why. I have an anecdotal story to tell you about my own ham station. And then I'll also tell you about working on a bench testing HF radios that went in aircraft when I was working for Collins Radio, and also testing antenna couplers. Now, my rig that I used for many years was an HW101 and this HA14, which is similar to the Heathkit SB200, supposed to be a 1 kilowatt power amplifier with two 572s in parallel. I'll wait for the beep. Now, I built this power amplifier from a kit, and it has a reflectometer in it that's in the output, not the input, of the power amplifier. And what you do is you tune the power amplifier for maximum output when you put the exciter in the tone test mode, not in the actual single sideband mode, of course. And you tune the transmitter exciter also for maximum output. And Heathkit is assuming that you're going to have an antenna that's going to look at least fairly close to 50 ohms. The reflectometer that's in there is as you described, it uses an enamel wire that's snaked through under the shield of a piece of coax that goes to the output connection. And what you do is there's a potentiometer and diode in the circuit where you tune the potentiometer for full scale, and you tune the power amplifier and the exciter for the maximum power you can get out. And then you switch to reverse, and it picks up the other diode and gets reflected power. And it's supposed to read the ratio that says WR. And all of Heathkit's reflectometers work that way. I know I've worked on SB200s that have the same thing, and I worked on independent SWR bridges that these kids sold that had the same circuit, basically. I'll wait for the beep. Now, working on a bridge and having the finest of Hewlett Packard test equipment, and I have photographs of myself at the bench, so maybe someday I'll make attachments and send them around by email if you're interested. And we did quite a bit of evaluating of these complex load antennas. And one of the things I did, which was not in any of the books or service manuals to do, was to couple a little link to a BNC connector on the complex dummy load box. And with that, I was able to go to an oscilloscope, and I was also able to see if the power amplifier was not operating linearly, because if it gets a lot of bad news back to it, it can stop operating linearly. And I've never seen a diagram in the book of the picture you get with one mode of operating non-linearly. And it's, you're feeding the single sideband transmitter for full power and using a two-tone method, because one tone will just give you a solid carrier, and two-tone will give you a modulated carrier. And what happens when it goes in a certain type of linearity, you get a hatchet picture. In other words, you get the top of the peaks, you get like a hammer, is the best way I could describe it. And this is when the reflected power gets to the point where the linearity of the final is destroyed. I'll wait for the beep. Now, a lot of things can fool people when they don't have the proper instrumentation. And if you're just looking at voltage, you're not proving anything, because the voltage has to be in phase with the current to get full power measurement. If you have voltage and you don't have current, strictly by the power formula, you're not getting the full power, even though you're getting a high reading of voltage. And when does that happen? It happens when you have a reactive load. Reactance causes power factor to change even on 60 hertz. So you can imagine what it does on HF. And that's why there's a lot of confusion. Because you have to have the current and the power in phase, the current and the voltage in phase, to get the rated power. And all of my work at home, I've never used an antenna coupler other than the variables that are in the power amplifier and the transceiver. Never found a need for it. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Dick, from W2ILT. Go.
Hey, you brought up a good point. I'm looking at my Heath Kit, so-called kilowatt amplifier. In the world, the model number of it, SB200, I think it is. It has a real tuning and loading control on that plate tank circuit, the Pi network, on that output transmitting tube, or two tubes, whichever it is. And so it needs no matchbox. It's built into that amplifier. I'll bet you there are people who bought a high-power amplifier and got talked into buying a matchbox, and they didn't really need it. So, again, a lot of misunderstanding occurs. Mel, I know we should have set aside even an earlier time to go to your mailbag, and I think we better do that right now. I had a whole presentation I was going to make on the subject of Toyota automobiles. I've discovered two very pivotal documents. After Mel goes through his mailbag, for those who are willing to stay around a little bit beyond 12 o'clock, I'll give you the email address where you can find these extremely valuable documents on the subject of the investigation by National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and also a major organization in the United Kingdom that is doing an investigation paid by NHTSA as to what is the Toyota situation. The bottom line is there is a tremendous amount of gathering evidence that it is not the gas pedal. I repeat that. There's a lot of evidence that quite possibly the major problem is not the gas pedal. When you go to these two documents that I'll give you the websites for after Mel finishes, and you go to those websites and you look at those graphs of all of the runaway vehicles that have been occurring since 1999, there's a tremendous number of them, all makes and models and whatever. Let me drop. And there's a similar situation that took place in the 80s with Audi, and there's a similar situation that took place in Germany with BMWs. So runaway vehicles are not new. And when you look at all of the evidence that is now being gathered, it is not the gas pedal, most likely. And so I think a lot more is going on during these recalls. And the recalls, by the way, are now exceeding 8 million vehicles. I think it's approaching 9 million vehicles. And hopefully they're going to do a lot more than just the gas pedal. K2KEY, what are you getting in your email these days? K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N. I want to get one quick question and probably something else.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I know Mel has been into a lot of pieces of equipment, and a few months ago, there was a topic about these MOVs, metal oxide varistas. The topic revolved pretty much around surge protectors and things of that nature. I was wondering if these things are popular, you know, in other pieces of equipment. Are they in our new hand gear or, you know, our HF rigs or are these MOVs in our, you know, other, you know, equipment, TVs, VCRs, whatever, or is it just primarily found in these surge protectors? Back to you, Dick, and then I guess you could either answer or no. WS1.
Dick, just with a quick comment.
Back to Paul first. Paul, I don't understand your question. You're asking a question about metal oxide varistas, MOVs. What is your question? Are they located inside of a tape recorder, or are they located into the external box of the surge protector that we buy? What is your question, Paul?
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't make myself clear on that. But I know they're in the surge protector. That was the topic a few months ago. But are they in TVs? Are they in our ham equipment, the HF rigs? Are they in digital players, you know, other modern pieces of equipment, Dick? Are they everywhere?
Okay, so I guess your question for Mel is, where are they located? Are they in anything else other than the surge protectors we buy? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Yes and no. I have seen them in a number of different devices, such as this. I opened up this cable box. This digital converter box, and they do have a couple of MOVs in there on the line. The computers, most of the computers, it is in that little power supply box where you put the plug in the back of the computer. It usually plugs directly into the power supply box as a male connector in there, and it's located behind that male connector. Whether or not it's put into all products depends on the company. A lot of stuff, you know, cheapy, and they'll leave it out, even though in many cases it should be in there. So you really have to really look carefully, Paul. It's not a cut and dry, rules that it must be in that device, over.
Comment and to any new.
And I did have a comment as well.
Alex and Wesley recognize, but first up, Mel, it is my belief that these metal oxide varistors have a finite number of pulses that they can absorb. That on each pulse that you absorb with an MOV, you are chewing up some of the inside material of the MOV. And eventually, if you're in an area that has a whole lot of surges, you eventually blast the thing open and it's no longer giving you any protection. That is my belief. I wonder if you also have a similar belief. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, I have never seen any of them blasted other than once that, you know, where it's been lightning involved, really thick pulses. And any of the equipment I've taken apart that have them, I've never really run across ones that look physically damaged, Dick, because I guess you'd have to really, like you say, really test them, but I would assume that if they are, you know, deteriorated, that they would be physically, you'd be able to see it, over.
Okay, in our environment, it's not so bad. A guy I work with lived for a few years in Gainesville, Florida, the lightning capital of the United States. Every single computer he ever had in that environment during the few years he lived there got blasted. He had these surge protectors. He was cascading surge protectors, and each of these surge protectors he was using and cascading would give him a certain number of protection lightning bolt shot, so to speak, and eventually he burned through the surge protector box, and eventually it got the computer anyhow. And he was also putting surge protectors on the web line that was connected to the computer. So if you're living in a place like California, like Florida, which has got a lot of lightning, you might need some more of the devices that are really a vacuum glass tube thing made by Polyphaser, among other companies. The MOV is an inexpensive device, but in a really severe environment, it only gives you a certain number of shots before it is no longer effective. I wonder if that's sort of the information you're looking for, Paul. Where you live, it's probably not that bad. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I've come across a piece of equipment, computers, DVD players, no ham equipment, but the things have just quit, and it seems to be in the power supply unit. You look for it, and I see these little white things that look like capacitors, and from what I understand from the net, most likely the MOBs. So, to me, they sound like they were problematic. I remember you discussing that a while back, Dick, so, if I come across one, I wonder if I could just, jump it, or maybe put a fuse in its place, and maybe I could make some of these dead pieces of equipment come on, come back to life. And I just hope they're not in, ham equipment. They sound problematic. Although Mel seems to think they're okay, but it's like one vote against, and you think they're problematic, Dick. So I don't know. It sounds iffy to me. I remember the crowbar syndrome, the crowbar circuit with Zener diodes. That seemed like the way to go. It looks like these MOBs have replaced that. Back to you, Dick.
Tell them, they're not wired in series with the line. They're wired from the line to the neutral, over.
You're absolutely right. They're in parallel. So if you think that your piece of equipment is not working because of the MOV, that's not likely. Assuming now that the voltage is really getting from your line cord into your box that's supposed to run on that 110 volts AC, so to speak. When in doubt, start measuring your MOV with an ohm meter, but the real way to test it would be to take it out of the circuit. I'm going to make a guess now. Put a 10 kilo ohm resistor in series with it, connect that to the 110 volt line, and on the far side of the 10K resistor is where the MOV is, and now measure with your AC voltmeter is the full voltage getting to the MOV. If the MOV is, got some kind of a failure where it starts conducting at 78 volts and doesn't go to 120, that's a safe way to do the test with a series 10K resistor. You don't want to put that directly across the 110 volt line. You make it smoke and flames if it's a bad one. These are just guesses on my part. And you got to worry about the fact that they only take a certain number of shots. So if you're in a really bad environment, you're using up your MOV. Around here, we don't get those kind of conditions most of the time. Into XJN, and then Alex in that order. Alex first, and then here we go. Wesley first, into XJN. Go right ahead, Wesley.
Okay, November to X-ray, to get November. Well, I've got it. Look, you're talking about the antenna tuners and the P filters and the amplifiers. That actually, you made a lot of mess in the minds of ones that are not very much knowledgeable. Because once you say that it is, it does not do very good to the antenna. That was your statement. And then at the same time, you look at your amplifier and then you say, "Well, I have a full P in my amplifier. I do have a perfect antenna matcher. That one that you can buy standalone." But then you say that you can have an antenna matcher independently and that will actually tune that antenna. Don't you think that some people may get confused and to XJN?
Okay, I'm going to repeat it. And I'm going to try to make it a little bit more clear. Assuming my antenna is not a good impedance match to my particular transmission line, and I'm making corrective action in the shack by way of either a separate matchbox / antenna tuner, or I just have to have a transmitter that really has tuning and loading control, that's got a real Pi network in the final. Doesn't matter whether the Pi network in the final of the transmitter is there or whether my matchbox is there. In any of those cases, as long as my tuning and loading controls don't run out of range, I can make the transmitter completely happy, and I can get full performance out of that transmitter. As long as my feed line is low enough in loss, I can get full performance out of that antenna. That's the good news. The bad news, no matter what you do in the shack, it will not change the true standing wave ratio of your antenna. It could take an antenna that is out of resonance. That's a fancy way of saying it has a high viswar. Whether you say the antenna is a high viswar because it's presenting a 10-ohm impedance, that would be a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio on a 50-ohm line, or I could say that it's so far out of resonance that it's producing a strong reactance that's making a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. It's got nearly 100 ohms of reactance in series with 50 ohms. Doesn't matter. Either of those is a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. And let me drop. If the Pi network of my transmitter has enough tuning range and loading range, and those tuning and loading controls don't run out of range, or correspondingly my matchbox has enough range to match that, I can make that work. You could say I'm re-resonating the antenna if it's got that series reactance, or I could say I'm re-impedance matching that antenna if it's a pure 10-ohm resistor. The pure 10-ohm resistor is a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. A 50-ohm resistor in series with 100 ohms of reactance is a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio. They are identical as far as the antenna tuner is concerned if I've got the right length of feed line. As I change the length of feed line and I walk around that circle of 5-to-1 standing wave ratio on the Smith chart, I'm going to see every possible impedance. 100 ohms of capacitor reactance or 100 ohms of inductive reactance. Those are two places on the Smith chart. 10 ohm impedance or 250 ohms of impedance. Those are two other places on the Smith chart. As I walk around that transmission line, I get every one of those impedances. Doesn't matter, as long as my impedance matching network in the shack can match it, I can get full performance out of that antenna. I wonder if that's a little bit more clear, and I know that not everyone's going to accept all that the first time they hear it. N2XJS, K2RIW.
Dick, for me it is very much clear, and I do agree with everything that you say. If you said that that's what you say is controversial, it does not sound controversial to me. It is pretty much clear and pretty much straightforward. I was just worried about the fact that some of the people listening to that, because of this information being given in pieces, may not understand the principles. Back to you, Dick and Tershia.
K2RFN. RFN recognized, but Alex is first. I think it was K2RFN. Alrighty, I'm glad you brought it to my attention. Maybe we made it a little bit more clear. But standing wave ratio, antenna tuners, antennas themselves, transmission lines, this TechNet, that is probably the main subject that has been discussed for 27 and a quarter years. When we look at all of the subjects that have come to this TechNet since September of 1982, those particular subjects may very well be the most frequently discussed subject because they're most frequently misunderstood. Not an easy subject. The way it's taught in our schools leaves a lot to be desired. Alex was the next person with an assignment, N2MNU, K2RIW. Go ahead, Alex.
Okay. Now that personally raised the question, the issue again, I will try to make it clearer for him and everybody else. But the issue that I wanted to address was the MOVs, the metal oxide varistors, or how they sold nowadays are resettable fuses. But let's first address the issue of the understanding what antenna tuner is. We can think about an antenna tuner as a two-port black box. It really doesn't matter what's inside. This black box has one input, well, has two ports, one on the left, one on the right. The one on the left is connected through a cable to the transmitter. The one on the right is connected through a cable to an antenna. The transmitter and the antenna have different parameters, different impedances, so they have to be adapted one to each other. What the black box is doing is taking half of it, the left half of it, and adapt itself to the transmitter. Then it takes the right half of it and adapts itself to the antenna. And then in the middle of it, there is a little part of it, the miracle of it, that adapts both parts to each other. So you can think of an antenna as a three-part system. Input adaptation, output adaptation, and then in between, the adaptation between the two systems. So this will make clear that the antenna and the feeder and everything else outside is not changed, but only inside the box, the parameters of the box are changed in such a way that will adapt itself to the outside conditions. Perhaps that will make a little bit more clearer the issue. Now, with respect to the resettable fuses, those are sold like that, under that name, and they are used usually when you have to deal with very, very long line. Telephone lines are usually MOVs, using MOVs on a regular basis. DSL lines, the same. Anytime you have a line that is going through miles and miles of wires, you will find those MOVs. What they are resettable resistive devices. A certain amount of voltage.
Repeater, timeout.
Meaning that next time when you are triggering the device, the short circuit that is presented when the high voltage kicks in will be less efficient than before. So after a number of kicks, you will have a very high resistance when the MOS is triggered, and you will have to throw it away. This is basically what they are, resettable fuses. The catalog of them is made by a firm called Tikor, and they're pretty darn good. You can buy them in any voltage you want to, any trigger voltage in any configuration. And yes, they are connected between the lifeline and some sort of ground and whatever. Sometimes they are connected between the two lines also, but then you have to be careful because they have a very high capacitance, and when you are dealing with, let me drop it, dealing with high frequency signals like DSLs and modems, you have to be careful not to load capacitively the line. Back to you, Dick.
Comment, W2ILT.
Yeah, you did time out the machine, Alex. Before you dropped it at the end, you timed out the machine. Good to know that the MOVs are, what was the word I was going to use? The word you were looking for is transformation. Yes, the matchbox adapts to the transmitter side, adapts to the antenna side, and it creates the correct transformation in between the two. In theory, lossless transformation. And thank you for that information on MOVs. Bob wanted to make a comment, and Mr. RFM also wants to make a comment. Let me pick up Mr. RFM first, because he signed in earlier. K2RFM, Romeo Foxtrot Mike, I think was your call letters. If so, your name might be Bob. Go right ahead with your comment. K2RIW, the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Dick, it's KC2RFN, Radio Foxtrot, November, and the name is Alan. I just want to make two quick points here. As far as the matching networks go, there was a question in the general exam that I just took a couple of Tuesdays ago with Bob as the VE, and this conversation reminded me of this question, which is very straightforward and touches on the basics of what you all are talking about. And by the way, I liked Alex's description of how these matching boxes work. But the question reads, if the SWR on an antenna feed line is 5-1 and the matching network at the transmitter end of the feed line is adjusted to 1-1 SWR, what is the resulting SWR on the feed line? And of course the answer is 5-1. It's all right there, and they give a lengthy explanation as to why, but it's a very important concept, important enough to be included on the general exam. I'm going to drop the second. The thing I wanted to bring up is the ARRL award nominations are open. One of the awards that's up for grabs is the ARRL Technical Service Award, which recognizes a licensed radio amateur or individuals who are licensed radio amateurs who provide amateur radio technical assistance or training to others. The nomination deadline is March 31st, 2010. I nominated Dick. Everybody can nominate somebody. I could think of a few people who are deserving as Dick is, so I submitted his name. I would recommend everybody submit a name who they feel is appropriate, but I think Dick certainly is deserving of it, so I just wanted to throw it out there and say the deadline is the 31st. Just go to the ARRL website and just type in the ARRL Technical Service Award, and up will come the nomination screen. That's it. KC2RFM. Back to you, Dick.
I thank you for that, Alan. And I'm kind of embarrassed I didn't recognize your call letter's name earlier, because you did send an email to me. But I never remember a name, and I always forget a face. I'm quite forgetful on names, as you can tell, and call letters. That's why I keep asking everyone to give me their name each time they sign in. And, of course, that's a little bit discouraging for people who have signed in for years and years, and they haven't signed in for the last month, and all of a sudden I forget their name. Sorry about that. Thank you for the information. Okay, now, let's see. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who wanted to make a comment. And Mel, boy, we made about 4 attempts in the last hour to get to your email, and we didn't. You want to try one? It's your choice. K2RIW, K2KEY, you got it, Mel.
Bob, come ahead.
Please stand by, Bob. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, a little bit on to the midnight, so I think that we're going to lose a good part of the audience. I mean, unless you want to continue this, Dick, that's really up to you. I've got lots of emails and all. I pounded out a number of them. I tried to answer, but I got ones that seem to predominate every so often. As far as the car situation, I'm just going to make one quick comment. My brother had a problem with his Mercedes, 1989 first Mercedes, with a runaway system situation like that. So, as you mentioned, it is not something I believe that is a new occurrence. I think it's been most likely never really brought up because they figure there's so small percentage of the automobiles on the road, and I think that's why they ignored it over.
It's a complicated issue. The first time most of us in the United States first became aware of it is in the middle 80s. Audi had something like a quarter of a million vehicles that had to be recalled because a significant number of people were running into the
at 830 W2VL repeater system.
But we're running into the unintended acceleration, sudden acceleration, sudden undesired acceleration, SUA, I think it's called. And when you read these new documents that I found, you realize that it's been going on for a long time. Many organizations have been in denial, including NHTSA. What makes me extremely angry as I read these reports is that NHTSA opened, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, opened up a research for runaway vehicles on a large number of occasions. They opened up a OTI, I forgot what that stands for now, Operational Defect Investigation. And almost every one of those ODIs was closed out with no conclusion, and the reason for the closeout is insufficient information. Wow. On top of that, they have recently decided to intentionally close out the ones where a fatality occurred because they no longer could, I am guessing they're doing that because they can no longer interview the driver because of the fatality. Boy, that doesn't sound right. If you think absence of evidence is evidence of absence, boy, that's extremely naive. Let me drop. So what I can do for you guys is I can give you the website where you read these articles yourself. And if you're at all like me, you're going to be mildly horrified. And there's a significant amount of evidence. It is not the gas pedal. It is not the sticking gas pedal. There's a lot more going on with an awful lot of vehicles. So, and this may sound like it's off subject. This is the Mobile Amateur Radio Club. We amateurs use radios in our cars. And if that automobile malfunctions, that could become darn important. We have other radio friends that are also doing the same thing. We have non-radio friends and relatives who we want them to be safe in their cars. We amateurs communicate. We communicate with a lot of people in a lot of far-off places. So to get the word out as to what you should do and to protect yourself if the event occurs and what should you do to make sure that during the recall the right thing is being done to your vehicle, in my opinion, that's valuable information.
It sounds like conspiracy theory, isn't it?
Not at all. This is not conspiracy. This is normal human nature. Whenever you're running a large organization and you get a whole lot of phony complaints, you become kind of insular to phony complaints. And it's hard to tell the phony complaints from the real complaints. There's a tremendous number of people who have an accident in their automobile and they think the airbag didn't properly protect them and they sue the automobile manufacturer. And it may be a side impact, and the airbag doesn't protect you in most cases from a side impact. There's a whole lot of frivolous lawsuit that an automobile manufacturer runs into. And this is a small